It is Wednesday, July 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, the Democratic National Convention nominates former U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton as its presidential candidate, becoming the first woman to be nominated by a major party.
It's an achievement, I think. Many people are saying, really, you know, I mean, perhaps for Secretary Clinton, but really this is, I think people are seeing it, an achievement for American democracy.
Pope Francis expresses his horror following the killing of a Roman Catholic priest in France, and we visit a startup in California's Silicon Valley. It's all ahead. Well, Hillary Clinton on Tuesday officially secured the nomination of the Democratic Party to become its choice for president. I'm joined now by International Edition's Doug Bernard, who is at the convention in Philadelphia. So, Doug, it was quite dramatic in a lot of ways last night when Hillary Clinton received the nomination and her once rival for this, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, basically threw his support officially to her.
Exactly. It was dramatic, and it was very emotional, too. I mean, everybody who comes to these conventions loves the tradition of the call of the states, but this time it really was different. So what happened basically is they were keeping track of how many electoral votes for each candidate through each state, but they weren't running a tally. And the idea was that they were going to go through all of the states, literally A to Z, with one state sort of asking to pass, and that was Vermont. Basically, the idea was both campaigns agreed they wanted all of the committed delegates for both candidates kind of put on the record. And then once that was done, the convention turned back to Vermont, and Vermont, you know, they made their electoral votes clear. And then Bernie Sanders moved that Hillary Clinton be made the nominee by acclamation. So what it did is it both acknowledged, you know, both camps, the victories and the efforts of both camps and their supporters. And then at the end, it gave that, you know, unifying moment when her primary opponent, Bernie Sanders, stepped forward and said, you know, let's make her our nominee by acclamation.
And now Secretary Clinton is the first woman to be nominated by a major party to be president.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. In just 8 years, someone reminded me today, you know, how time passes, I guess. We've seen the first African-American become a major party presidential nominee, and now we have the first woman presidential nominee of a major political party in the United States. It's an achievement, I think. Many people are saying, really, you know, I mean, perhaps for Secretary Clinton, but really this is, I think people are seeing it, an achievement for American democracy, that this was something that many people have felt, Republicans, Democrats, Independents, was overdue. And whatever your particular feelings about Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton or any of the people who've been in this race, I think that everybody honestly looks at this moment and says, well, this is a special time in U.S. politics.
Well, Secretary Clinton's husband, former President Bill Clinton, gave a highly anticipated speech in support of his wife's candidacy.
He did. You know, in years past, Bill Clinton, President Clinton, has been something of the Democrats' secret weapon. They wheel him out whenever a candidate is needing a really good boost. And he's just, even on his off days, he's still probably one of the best political speechmakers the United States has seen. So that said, he delivered a fine address last night, a lot of it, at least in the beginning, focusing on how he met Hillary first, how he pursued her, and she wasn't necessarily so interested. It was not a policy speech. It was clearly a very kind of post-Bill Clinton presidency speech, in that his speeches now are really kind of focusing more on the personal and the emotional. So, but all that said, there was a sense that, you know, it was a good speech, and everybody loves Bill Clinton in this hall, but it fell a little bit flat for a number of reasons, you know, to a number of different years. So I think he did what he needed to do. He, you know, basically tried to introduce Hillary Clinton, not as the figure that we've all come to know over the last 25 years as a national political figure, but as a person, as an individual. So I think it did what it needed to do, but maybe not his very best speech ever.
Well, later tonight, President Barack Obama and Vice President Joe Biden, they will both be speaking about Hillary Clinton and the possibility she will become president.
Exactly. You know, and this is interesting, too, because, you know, obviously we know both of these individuals have worked very closely with Secretary Clinton in the Obama administration. They're clearly going to give her a full-throated endorsement, really making the case that she's just significantly more qualified to lead the nation than Donald Trump. But the interesting thing here is, of course, you know, among those two people you just mentioned were Vice President Joe Biden. Now, it really wasn't all that long ago, actually, that the vice president himself was considering running for the presidency in 2016. This was, you know, just about a year or so ago. And even at that time, he was probably more of a popular figure than Hillary Clinton. His family, however, experienced just a tragic loss of their son, Beau Biden, who died of brain cancer. Joe Biden, you know, basically kind of pulled himself out of the political scene for a while and just said, I so want to run for president, but it's just not right, the right time for me and for my family. And his moment has passed. And that really was his last, I think, real shot. So it'll be interesting to hear his comments today, both from the perspective of someone who genuinely believes she's qualified, but also maybe somewhere deep inside has a little bit of that regret that it's not him getting the nomination tonight.
All right. Well, that's International Edition's Doug Bernard at the Democratic Convention in Philadelphia. Thanks so much, Doug.
Thank you.
Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky with a look at what's trending. So, Andrew, what's going on?
Well, a lot of talk about that big night last night at the Democratic National Convention, the first woman to be nominated as a major party presidential candidate. And the phrase we keep seeing again and again on social media is the glass ceiling is broken. The ceiling is broken. The idea that this is one of the last barriers for women in the United States, that there hasn't been a female presidential candidate and not yet a female president. So a lot of Democrats very excited about that and excited about November to potentially break that last glass ceiling to have a female president. Bill Clinton, in his speech last night, he was talking about the real Hillary Clinton versus the cartoon one that Republicans have made up. And he said, the real one versus the cartoon one. Well, hashtag the real one became kind of a viral hashtag where people saying, I'm with the real one. And they were using that to support Hillary Clinton. So I don't know if that was planned or not, but it did develop into a hashtag after that speech. Now, on the other side, you have Donald Trump and Republicans focusing on this Democratic National Committee email hack that's kind of thrown the Democrats into a bit of strife. Allegations that Russia was behind the attack. There are a lot of calls from Republicans that this needs to be investigated further. Donald Trump even saying that Russia needs to go and, if they made this hack, find more emails from Hillary Clinton from her time as Secretary of State as part of her email controversy. Now, that's not sitting well with a lot of people. They're saying that Trump is kind of goading Russia into hacking the U.S., so they're not pleased with that. But others are defending Trump, saying, you know what, it shouldn't be a problem if there's nothing to hide in the emails. So that back and forth continues across the political spectrum. But we'll end with something positive, and positive change brought about by social media. Now, our listeners might remember a couple years ago the ice bucket challenge.
Oh, yes.
Where people took the buckets of ice water and they dumped them on themselves.
I was one of those people, I should confess.
Yes, yeah. I was able to avoid it, but on a day like today, it's very hot here in Washington, D.C., it wouldn't be a bad thing. But anyway, the ice bucket challenge to raise money for ALS research, also known as Lou Gehrig's disease, well, it raised $115 million over the course of the campaign. Researchers announcing today that they've actually made a huge step forward in discovering the gene that carries ALS, and they said that because of the ice bucket challenge, they were able to do that work and move closer to maybe finding a cure for this disease. So the power of social media and viral memes, it's not just a silly thing sometimes. Sometimes it can do real good in the world.
Oh, that's absolutely terrific. Well, thanks, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. Here are some of the top stories trending. A massive truck bomb kills more than 40 people in Syria. The man who tried to assassinate former President Ronald Reagan will be released from a psychiatric hospital. All charges are dropped against Baltimore police in the Freddie Gray trial, and the U.S. is encouraged to see direct dialogue between China and the Philippines on maritime disputes. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute. After NASA's Dawn spacecraft passed by the heavily cratered dwarf planet Vesta on its way to Ceres, mission scientists expected that it too would also be extensively pitted with huge craters. But after Dawn arrived at Ceres back in March 2015, the scientists were surprised to see that it did not have as many large craters as they expected. According to a new study published in the journal Nature, Ceres geology has undergone a significant evolutionary process which could have rubbed out its big craters many years ago. While Ceres did not have the number of huge craters that was expected, the scientists did find that it has three huge planitiae, or ground indentations, that measure nearly 800 kilometers across. They suspect that these surface depressions may actually be the remains of big asteroid impacts. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we visit a startup in California's Silicon Valley. Pope Francis began his first trip to Poland Wednesday under the shadow of this week's gruesome murder of a French priest in Normandy by two suspected Islamists. The killing was the latest in a series of attacks that have shocked the people of France and Germany. The Vatican said the Pope was horrified at the news that the attackers burst into a church service, forced the 86-year-old priest to his knees, and slit his throat. French President François Hollande, who visited the site of the attack, said the Islamist militant threat to Europe has never been greater. White House Deputy Press Secretary Eric Schultz condemned what he called the horrific terrorist attack in the strongest possible terms.
We offer our condolences to the family and friends of the murdered priest, and our thoughts and prayers are with the other victims of the attack, as well as the parishioners and community members of this church. France and the United States share a commitment to protecting religious liberty for those of all faiths, and today's violence will not shake that commitment. We commend French law enforcement for their quick and decisive response and stand ready to assist the French authorities in their investigation going forward.
The attack came less than 2 weeks after a French Tunisian mowed down 84 people with a truck in the southern French coastal city of Nice. Benjamin Haddad, a French analyst at the Washington-based Hudson Institute, tells International Edition's Victor Beatty it is yet another example of a security breakdown in France.
This was, as is often the case, a person who was already known of the authorities. He had tried two times to go to Syria through Turkey, had been arrested at the borders. The second time he had actually been arrested and tried in France, so he had been incarcerated for 10 months. And then was afterwards put in house arrest with an electronic tag that supposedly was supposed to be able to track his movement and prevent him from fleeing or carrying such an attack. So once again, you see, you know, shortcomings, especially when it comes to the judicial system, not so much intelligence or security, but the legal and judicial system in preventing these attacks.
Ben, this comes less than 2 weeks after a Tunisian plowed a truck into a crowd at the French Riviera city of Nice, killing 84, an attack also claimed by Islamic State. Is this a failure of French government?
Yeah, I mean, obviously the accumulation of these attacks, and you have to put it also in the context of attacks in Germany, which have been followed all over Europe and in France. So there's been the accumulation of attacks by what we call lone wolves, but are actually clearly inspired by the Islamic State, its rhetoric, its orders as well, and the way they carry the attacks. I mean, the truck in Nice was clearly a method that had been advocated by jihadists for years on websites. The gruesome way in which the attack was carried today was also clearly a reference to the beheadings and the throat slit on ISIS videos. So clearly you have now this accumulation of people who are being inspired to act by the Islamic State, and the European authorities are being overwhelmed by the multiplication of this threat.
President Hollande said that the French people will use all their means within the law to fight Islamic State. What might that mean?
France is still in a state of emergency. The state of emergency has actually been renewed after the Nice attack. So the country has been in a state of emergency for 7 months now, since the November 13th attack at the Bataclan. The president after Nice has called on reservists to join the army and fight on the French territory and defend sensitive sites on the French territory. The authorities have called on French citizens, especially youth, to join the reserve to try to alleviate the pressure on security forces that are really strained right now in France. And there's an ongoing debate over how to adapt our legal and police system to this new threat in the boundaries, obviously, of the rule of law and the Constitution. But the ongoing debate that's been going on for almost a year now in the country is on how to adapt the legal system to try to prevent people who are already under surveillance, who are already listed, from carrying such attacks.
That's Benjamin Haddad of the Hudson Institute. He says the threat posed by Islamist attacks has increased dramatically in the past 2 years with the rise of the Islamic State and the civil war in Syria. He said while about 70 French citizens joined al-Qaeda in the past decade during the Afghan conflict, some 1,500 Frenchmen have joined ranks with or been inspired by the IS group since the Syrian civil war broke out in 2011. He said the French security services are trying to catch up with this growing threat. Well, this week, Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull ordered an investigation into the alleged abuse of Aboriginal juveniles at a detention center.
We are determined to get to the bottom of this. We're determined to examine the extent to which there has been a culture of abuse and indeed whether there has been a culture of cover-up.
Australian television aired footage Monday showing teenage defenders being stripped naked, tear-gassed at close range, held in solitary confinement, and in one case, a 17-year-old appeared hooded and shackled to a chair for 2 hours. According to the report, juveniles from 10-year-olds to 13-year-olds were locked in small, high-security cells with no running water or natural light at the Dondale Detention Center, which has been the subject of complaints for years. The Northern Territory has the highest rate of youth detention in the country, and 97% of its juvenile detainees are Aboriginal. Human rights activists have accused the government of ignoring the issue for years. Turnbull said the Australian Royal Commission is expected to begin holding hearings in September, with a final report due early next year. This is VOA.
Democracy in action. That's what the U.S. presidential election is all about. Who's going to be the new president of the United States come November 8th? Tune in to VOA's coverage of the 2016 presidential election. Reports, expert analysis, and more. Professional, up-to-the-minute coverage that can't be found anywhere else. Right here on VOA.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
This is International Edition. Silicon Valley is a technology powerhouse and a place that companies such as Google, Facebook, and Apple call home. It's a region in Northern California that stretches from San Francisco to San Jose. But more than that, it's known for its startup culture. VOA's Elizabeth Lee went inside one company to find out what it's like to work in a startup.
Running a company with a treadmill inside in the middle of Silicon Valley is not what Monisha Prakash had imagined when she and her parents immigrated to the U.S. from Nepal.
I tell you, when I first moved out here, I got a call from my father, who was living in Texas, and he said, you know, Monisha, I've looked all over the map and I can't find the Silicon Valley anywhere.
Prakash says Silicon Valley is not just a region in California, but a culture that embodies entrepreneurship. The culture is infectious, she says, and it touched her when she came to Silicon Valley.
At first, my parents were very confused. I had started out pre-med, and I got into medical school. And when I chose not to go, they didn't understand why.
Prakash says she and her two co-founders wanted to form a startup using technology to improve the lives of people. Their answer was Lumo Body Tech, a company that developed wearable sensors to improve posture and help runners avoid injury.
There are a lot of studies that show posture being highly correlated with back pain, back health.
Charles Wong, whose parents are from Taiwan, started as a doctor but became an entrepreneur. He says this sensor, called the Lumo Lift, vibrates when the wearer slouches as a reminder to sit up, reducing the risk of back pain. Another sensor can be worn while a person is running and tracks the runner's movement. Paired with a mobile phone, it can provide personalized coaching to the runner.
Increase the time your foot is on the ground. Pump your arms and finish each arm swing with your...
Being a part of a startup is similar to running, says another co-founder, Andrew Chang.
Magnitude. Like, you can't even compare the speed that you move at, the speed in which you make decisions, and which things happen, and so on and so forth, because there is a lot less bureaucracy.
Wong says being a part of a startup means one has to learn quickly and meet new challenges every day.
Super fun. I mean, I think I've learned so many different things in the role that I've had here.
Prakash says it's fun because there's a spirit of collaboration throughout Silicon Valley, and it's fueling the startup culture here. She says seeing the success of her startup has been a source of joy for her parents.
I want to make them proud, and I want them to know that by giving us this opportunity to pursue anything we want, pursue our dreams, that I'm carrying that on. And so in a lot of ways, it's an honoring them that I do what I do.
For anyone who wants to follow in her footsteps, Prakash says, do not fear failure. Embrace it as an opportunity to learn.
Increase your steps per minute to
Elizabeth
improve
Lee,
the
VOA News,
foot.
Mountain View, California.
That's our show. Please remember to visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On July 28th, we observe the 65th anniversary of the adoption by the United Nations General Assembly of one of the most important humanitarian documents of the modern era, the UN Convention relating to the status of refugees. Better known as the 1951 Refugee Convention, it is a multilateral treaty that defines who is a refugee and sets out the rights of individuals who are granted asylum. The Refugee Convention is the first international agreement dealing with the most fundamental aspects of a refugee's life, beginning with the requirement that signatory nations must protect all refugees that are on their territory. It also stipulates that refugees must be allowed certain freedoms, including the right to practice their religion, the right to work, and the right to acquire an education. They must be allowed access to travel documents and should be allowed freedom of movement. The UN Refugee Convention also emphasizes that refugees have certain obligations to the host government, such as to respect the laws and regulations of their country of asylum. Most importantly, the convention makes it very clear that a refugee may not be repatriated involuntarily to a country where he or she fears persecution. The document stemmed from the refugee crisis of 1945, when over 40 million people who were displaced by the Second World War flooded Europe in need of resettlement. Today, we find ourselves in the midst of another refugee crisis, the largest the world has seen since the catastrophe that spurred the creation of the document in the first place. According to UNHCR estimates, more than 20 million people around the world meet the convention's definition of a refugee. On this, the 65th anniversary of the signing of one of the cornerstone documents that defines our common humanity, let us not forget our history and work toward never repeating it again. Let us open our hearts to refugees wherever they are, help however and whenever we can, until such a time that they can make their way back home.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.